twists the wires, you know. Twists and breaks the wires when you...
Oh, on these?
Okay. Good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, February 15, 2010. We got started a little bit late because the floor session went a little bit long. On the agenda today, we're going to be looking at some items that we had seen in the past and we want to get updates on. The first is the State Board of Investment, and the reason why is because we had a law that was passed last year, Minnesota's laws 2009, Chapter 90, which on the State Board of Investment to divest itself of investments in Iran, and we required a report to the legislature on that. So, Mr. Bicker is here from the State Board. Mr. Bicker, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Howard Bicker. I'm the Director of the State Investment Board. What I'd like to do briefly this afternoon is go over, at least I was told I was supposed to give a little update on both Iran and Sudan legislation. The Sudan legislation was passed in 2007 and Iran was passed in the 2009 session. Both pieces of legislation followed basically the same template. Upon enactment, the State Board was given 90 days to come up with a list of companies that were affected by the legislation, whether they had operations in Sudan or in Iran. And we were to get independent verification, and we are using various sources for that information. We use something called the Conflict Risk Network for the Sudan and Risk Metrics for Iran. Once that list had been provided to us, we sent letters to all the companies affected, identifying them that they were on the list that says that they had active business operations in the countries, and that if they did not either sell those operations or convert those operations to inactive business, that we would be prepared to divest those companies. And the Sudan, I mean, we've done all of this stuff. Iran, we have just completed and gotten the letters back. Then we need to determine a list of companies to be divested. The Sudan list ended up with 10 companies that were divested with approximately $28 million in value. The Iran list is just being finalized. It will be finalized within a month. The current list has approximately 26 companies on it with a market value of about $182 million. We also are, on an ongoing basis, communicating to our various money managers the list, because whether we own the stock or don't own the stock, the companies on the list are restricted from purchases. And these lists are, for lack of a better word, ongoing or dynamic lists, in the sense that they change on an ongoing basis. And therefore, we're communicating with our managers on approximately a quarterly basis to let them know of new additions and or deletions. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that's a quick overview of the Sudan and Iran legislation. If there are any questions, I'd gladly respond.
Did you say it was $182 million that was affected in total investments?
Mr. Chairman, in the $182 million is the Iran legislation.
Okay.
And that's potential at this stage. We do not have a finalized list and have not divested anything in Iran. The first divestitures are required in two phases. 50% must be done within 9 months of the establishment of the list. The 100% must be done in 15 months. The nine-month date will be July of this year. So no we don't have a finalized divestiture list for Iran yet. That will be done within the next month. Then we will have to July to sell 50% of those securities, and then to next January to sell the balance.
Okay. Have you run into any problems trying to identify these companies, and especially when you've got, you know, global investments, it sometimes might be difficult to track down who's got what interests. Did it just go smoothly? How would you describe the process that you went through?
Mr. Chairman and members, for the most part, we have to rely on external sources. We are not in the position to make those determinations. The external source for Sudan is, again, something that is now the conflict risk network. It used to be the Sudan Divestment Task Force. They provide this service to us on an ongoing basis, free of charge. Iran is a different story. We had to, again, provide that input to us from an external source. This firm's called Risk Metrics, and we have to pay a retainer to them to keep this information and to get this information. You know, when we got the letters back, and we've gotten some letters back, and they're in your packet, somebody's going to have to decide whether those letters are good, bad, or indifferent. And we are using the external source for consistency purposes.
So, and I'm looking at some of the letters regarding. So you'd contact these companies, and they responded back to you basically in various ways, saying that they did or did not have involvement in Iran. And so are you able to verify? You have to rely on external sources to tell you whether or not this is true or not. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's the way we've been proceeding.
Okay.
The most interesting part, Mr. Chairman, members, was try to find these places to mail some of these companies. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I had to find a map to find out where some of these little countries were. So.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
I'm sorry I came in a little bit late, but Mr. Bicker, did you say that you divested $20 million from Sudan?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, $28 million has been divested from the Sudan-related companies. Again, these numbers are ongoing. There may be companies added and so on and so forth over a period of time, but as of today, $28
million. So is it possible that companies that you're currently investing in, you may find out later on that they are doing business in restricted areas that, you know, either came to your attention or came about after you made the investments, and so you got to keep looking at them. Is that correct? So,
Mr. Chairman, that's true. That's we do quarterly updates with our managers and with the various vendors that provide us with this information.
And again, could you say you rely upon third parties? How do you go about how do you work with these third parties, and what information do you provide? You tell them, okay, tell us if we're investing in Sudan and Iran, and somebody gets back to you and say, yes, you are, no, you're not, or we don't know, or how does this communication go on so you know what's going on?
Mr. Chairman, this is a capitalistic society. The legislation that was passed as it relates to Sudan and Iran in Minnesota were not unique to Minnesota. And as soon as that happened, there were various organizations that said this is a business. And they got into that business very quickly. So there's two or three organizations that you can contact to get this sort of information.
For a fee, apparently.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Olstein.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bicker, because it was kind of a forced sale, did the state take a loss or break even?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, again, first of all, it is a forced sale. We have to sell these within predetermined periods of time as prescribed by legislation. It's not a forced sale in the sense we got to do it in a week. I mean, we right now know that, for example, we have to sell 50% of the Iran finalized list by July. So once that list is finalized, which will be sometime in February, we will have four or five months to do that. We'll have another 6 months to sell the balance. These are, for the most part, not large amounts of money in the overall scheme of the State Board of Investment. We currently have approximately $50 billion under management, so $28 million. Although if I had $28 million or you did, we probably wouldn't be here. but $28 million in our overall scheme isn't a lot. As far as whether we derived a profit or a loss in individual securities, I have not really looked at.
Sir Limmer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Biggers, if I remember right, regarding the Iran divestiture, there's been a number of other states that have also preceded Minnesota action, and they too have begun the divestiture of their public funds from corporations that invest in Iran. Have you had any discussion with any of these other states to determine if they have a list of investors that we may be involved with? I think there's close to 18 to 21 states that have divested their funds from Iranian investment places, and I was wondering if you've followed their trail at all.
Yeah, Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, I know almost all these people, and the reality is we all use the same services. So we're all operating off the same list for the most part. I mean, maybe one company here or there, but for all practical purposes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, same list.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you brought up a good point. It's going to be up to somebody to decide, because reading some of these letters, people say, well, we've had a contract signed in 2001. We can't leave, or it's detrimental if we were to leave. So are you planning to present to us maybe a list of companies that are still invested in these countries and, you know, the status of them, and if we should pull out or let it, what is our future going to be with them?
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olsen, at this stage, my job is to follow the law. And, you know, the law basically, in the Iran situation, talks about a $20 million investment. If somebody made an investment a number of years ago and they're in the process of unwinding that, again, there can be some discussions about whether they are becoming inactive or not. They made a $100 million investment and they got contracts for the next 20 years, they're in business. So it's really not my job to kind of plead somebody's case. It's my job to implement the law.
Any other questions? As I say, we wanted to circle back and see how these laws were actually working now. And so this is the opportunity to review that. Anything further? Well, if not, thank you, Mr. Becker, for the updates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
And here's a few other updates. Next, Department of Revenue. We've got a couple of items that we've had in the past before us, and we wanted to find out what's going on here. First is the Expanded Tax Compliance Initiative. We have somebody from Revenue here. And now, as you recall, of course, tax compliance is trying to collect all the unpaid taxes. And every year, as we try to come up with a budget balancing, we've made some very optimistic assumptions about how much is out there and how much we can get, and we keep building those numbers in, so we want to find out if they're actually working or not. So, Commissioner, welcome back to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chairman, my name is Dan Solomone. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to help any questions you have about our initiatives and legislation. I do have a handout.
Okay.
Distribute. Part of it is information you've seen at previous presentations. Good to have as part of this presentation.
Okay, go ahead while it's being handed out.
The first few pages of the handout, our background information about our mission and vision for those who may not have seen the earlier version. We also present what we call the compliance cycle, which is really important to think about tax administration as a process that involves several different kinds of activities, but they're all interrelated, from informing taxpayers of their obligations, providing tools for them, enforcement of ability enforcement. And also part of that wheel of all of our life cycle at the Revenue Department is making recommendations to the legislature for tax law changes that would correct some equities or provide administering the tax. So I'm looking at now bottom of page two. By the way, you'll notice on the upper left of your corner, there's a number three. Don't be confused by that. It's something that got on the slide, couldn't seem to get off. But I make reference to pages, I'll be referring to the lower right. So on the lower upper right, you'll see the compliance cycle on page two. Then there's some data about the department in terms of the scope of our services, the number of people served, for example, 3.6 million individual taxpayers. I won't read all those numbers off for you in the interest of time, but it's good to have that as a reference. And there's a little more of that data on the bottom, or the top of page three, in terms of the numbers. If you look at the bottom of page three, I remind you that the department essentially is become bifurcated over the years into two categories. We have the direct compliance activities, which involve collection enforcement and our various tax divisions that do the auditing work. And then on the other side of the house, we have compliance support, appeals and legal, the commissioner's office, part of the backroom function that support all of the online, frontline activities of tax enforcement. You'll notice tax operations is there. That's the whole filing and paying process. Tax research department that provides fiscal notes for you all during. If you look at the top of page four, we have updated percentages of direct compliance versus compliance support. And as you'll see, what we presented last year, 52% of the department's resources are in the form of direct compliance activities, 33% in the biennium 2000-2001, 52% direct compliance, 48% compliance support. And in contrast to that, in the 2010-2011, roughly 33% direct, 57% direct compliance, 33% compliance support. So there's been a shift away from direct compliance support to direct frontline compliance activities. And I'm not saying that's inappropriate. The concern we have over the long haul is to do that consistently year after year. It gets a little bit more difficult to manage and provide the kind of support that people on the front lines need to be more effective.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Roblin.
I guess I am not understanding the difference between the two. Could you give us an example of the type of support staff or whatever you're talking about?
Well, in terms of, go back to the slide on the bottom of page three. Direct compliance activities are basically our tax divisions. And generally they employ what we call revenue tax specialists. These are revenue examiners, they're accountants, collectors. They're on the front lines of determining that a liability is due and taking the steps to collect the monies owed to the Department of Revenue. That's the direct compliance activity. The compliance support are all the things we do to help those people do their job. Obviously, you have to have legal determinations from our legal department in terms of, you know, issues that come up during front office of the department, the commissioner's office, Commissioner Ines, myself, assisting commissioners who deal with policymaking, part of that support function. Our communications office, who that provides press releases and reacts to questions from the press on behalf of the department. We have a financial management division that makes sure that our monies are properly accounted for, and both in terms of state aids as well as our department budget. Resources is a traditional HR functions of hiring people and making sure they're in the proper salary ranges and so on. Then, of course, a big piece of compliance support nowadays is information systems. So we have a lot of new technology and we'll be reporting out on the progress of our recent project there. So those are the kinds of things that we call compliance support as opposed to the more frontline activities of auditors and collectors.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Roebling.
I'm a little confused by the trend to go to more compliance support than direct compliance. I thought that in the last few budget cycles, we had actually asked for more auditors that would be doing more direct compliance, I think, in order to bring up those revenues. How was that handled? Did we actually increase auditors, or did we increase more support?
Question.
Chair, Senator Roebling, there are two things. If you look, and I may have confused all of you getting here, if you look at the two circles, the 2000-2001, light green, the 48%, during that biennium, we were 48% direct compliance. Now at 2010-2011, 67%. So we have relatively more of the frontline activities. Our budget is frontline activities as opposed to the backroom activities. If you look at the black circles, 52% compliance support in the 2000-2001. I don't know if that would be the appropriate number, but the point is that it used to be 52%, and now it's 33%. So we're having a smaller contingent of people who are supporting a larger contingent of frontline people, sort of fewer backroom people, more frontline people. Probably the best way to summarize that. I hope that's helpful.
Mr. Chair, I see it now on the charts. I understand.
And the flip side of that is we've had compliance initiatives that bring in, that we put more people on the front lines every time we get a compliance initiative. We do not spend compliance money on compliance support. That's been the pattern as.
I think as we're going to see later on, I mean, over the years, we keep spending more and more money to hire more and more people, but it's been diminishing returns. I mean, it's, and that's just coming up. Commissioner?
Bottom of page four shows our complement over the years, and if you look at it, it's kind of a U-shaped diagram there. The bars fall from 1996 through about 2002. And that reduction has been a result of the department's shift to more IT priorities. For example, e-filing. We pushed e-file significantly in those years. And now we look at from 2002 on, you see the complement increasing, and all of those increases are substantially from new compliance initiatives that we received over the years, and we do have slide coming up on those. So it's not surprising that we had in the early years reduction in complement because of technology, better use of technology, and in the latter years, those compliance initiatives and additional direct support positions. Sorry, direct compliance positions. Page five is a snapshot of our budget. It's been updated for 2010-11. 7% general fund budget, and the rest are various other accounts, healthcare access, highway user tax, and environmental. The numbers here do not include the special revenue funds or open appropriations. To give you an idea of the size of our budget. Last time I was here, I presented some department challenges. I don't know that I need to go over the entire slide, but we did add a few new ones here. Obviously, we are in the midst of installing our new integrated tax system. I'll have more details about the status of that in a few minutes. One challenge for us has been to install the new tax processing system while continuing to operate with the old system. And the challenges that has created for us in terms of keeping track of where we are and accounting issues. Talked in the past about the loss of institutional knowledge. We expect in the next 5 years, I should probably say 4 years now because I told you that a year ago, I think. It's clear that in the next 5 years or so, we're going to lose about 20% of our employees, and they're going to be a lot of very seasoned people with a high degree of institutional knowledge. We're concerned about that, but I'm sure every other agency is as well. We have a growing percentage of younger less experienced employees. And I think the direct result of the compliance initiatives, we bring them in, get them up to speed as quickly as possible, but nowadays things get more complicated. It takes a little longer to get them trained, particularly with greater degree of technology. They have to learn systems as well as traditional duties of assessing and collecting. There's a growing stress on compliance support. That was what I was referring to earlier about the two pie charts. That obviously is something we need to all keep in mind. Get to a point where the imbalance gets so bad that it's difficult to sort of like baking a cake. You have to have the right recipe with eggs and flour. Auditors clearly need more system, are working more with systems now, so there's a challenge to get them trained in those areas. I talked in the past about the growing diversity of our taxpayers and our employees, which continues. And that's both a plus and a minus, depending on what we're talking about. We have more recently, because of the great emphasis put on by the Office of the Legislative Auditor on internal control, we have spent a lot of time training our employees on how to be compliant with the internal controls mandate. We have trained 1,173 of our employees. Basically nearly all of them. If you look at that bar chart we had earlier, we trained them in proper procedures for accountability for the OLA. Now, I think we were one of the largest agencies in terms of number of employees needed to be trained. We have a lot of people who deal with cash and deal with accounting information. Our Stassen building is approaching full capacity. That will be an issue for us in the future as we move forward any new initiatives. And in the past, we talked about turnover rates of auditors. That has is becoming less of a problem, perhaps because of the economy. So we are a little less concerned about that, but it may continue to be a problem for us. Top of page six begins a discussion or an update on the integrated tax system. This is one that I know you want to hear about. In August of 2007, we issued a request for proposals for a new integrated tax system, tax processing system. I'll give you a report on that. Set out for bid, competitive bid, and we contract in February of 2008 with a company called Fast Enterprises, an interesting, relatively small company whose principals are primarily former tax administrators of various states. And they sold us a product called GenTax, which is a commercial off-the-shelf product, not a customized software plan, but an off-the-shelf package that is automatically updated for us on an annual basis or biannual, depending on the changes that they make. So when the vendor has an update to the product, you automatically get that product. The work commenced in March of 2008. We have between 20 and 25 contractors on site at the Revenue Department. We have about 100 of our own actively involved installing this new software. The project was broken down into four rollouts. I'll quickly review the four of them. The first rollout was completed this December 15th of 2008, and the focus of that rollout was the installation of a sales and use tax component, Minnesota care tax, petroleum taxes, insurance taxes, and the mortgage registry and deed taxes. During rollout one, we converted nearly 650,000 taxpayer accounts, including owners and officers of companies, the GenTax product.
So does that mean that it's up and running now?
For those taxes listed,
okay.
We did switch over to production at the end of that period. It is running for those taxes.
Okay, and so you have a sense of whether or not the integrated tax system is working efficiently and I mean, the whole purpose of having that system was to do a better job of collecting the taxes. So you've got some experience now in can tell us whether it's working or not?
We do have a sense of that. I don't know. Greg Cheetah, if you want to get
we have it as a separate agenda item if you want to talk. We have it as a separate agenda item if you want to complete the discussion now. Or, I mean, this is part of your presentation, but as long as you're on it, maybe we can, you know, ask questions about it. Why don't you come on forward? And is the system working as it was advertised to us? Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Greg Cheetah, Minnesota Department of
You need to move your mic up a little closer to you. Yeah. Go ahead.
There's four rollouts, and we started out with certain taxes in each one of the rollouts. We've got the sales.
I don't think his mic is.
The first one. The second one Dan was going to talk about, which were corporate taxes and withholding taxes. That was rolled out in December of 2009.
Okay. Yeah.
Better?
Yeah.
Okay. This year, now we've started working on the individual income tax and some taxes, and then we also have a rollout four, which will occur a year from now, and that will pick up on some more of the special taxes like the alcohol, tobacco, and those. So the whole thing works together, and all of the pieces come together at the same time. You get to change the filing systems, the registration systems, the actual compliance systems, the auditing systems, the collection systems, and all the rest of that. Yes, they are starting to there's a whole big learning curve, I must admit. We've trained almost 1,000 people right now just with the taxes that we've looked at already. It is stressful on the department, but we are starting to see some benefit of it. As Dan was pointing out too, we haven't really been able to turn off a lot of the old systems at this point in time. We're hopeful in the next few months we can turn off a lot of like our business registration systems, because most of our business taxes will now be done in there. On the individual side, we really haven't. To a certain extent, the collection division has to work in two worlds right now, and so they're actually kind of hindered. Though they are starting to see some promise and being able to really take a holistic view of the taxpayer and the rest. But when you're still in the old collection system and in the new collection system, it's actually more work and a little bit more difficult. Something that we knew was going to be happening, and we knew that this was going to happen. But, yeah, we are starting to see some efficiencies in some of the filings in those types of areas. But some of the other areas we're actually still working in two systems, and it's actually more difficult than what it was.
So are you saying it's a bit too early to determine what efficiencies and savings we're going to have because you're still operating with the old and the new? Is that
correct?
Okay.
We are. Okay. I mean, we have seen very positive signs.
Okay. Positive signs such as what?
Actually, Terry, you want to come, if you don't mind?
Welcome to the budget division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Terry Steenblock, and I'm the director of the Collection Division for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. As Greg alluded to, we have a four-year rollout, so we're using multiple systems. One of the things that we have seen, though, is as we're working to get into the integrated system, we're reevaluating every process that we do and looking for ways to streamline that process or to leverage off of information that we didn't have in the past. And one of the examples I can talk to, one of the programs that we had, we've recently put into Gentex, not recently, it was during rollout one, which was December of 08, and we have seen a significant increase in our dollars collected. And the reason for that is because we're able to get to the debtors quicker, we're able to utilize the tools more effectively through some automation or individual people looking at these particular debts. And so the program that I'm referring to, we've seen over $11 million increase in revenue since putting it into the Gentex system. So we have seen quite a few successes. And again, a big component of that is because we are taking the opportunity to look at our existing practices and what we do and how we do and how can we leverage off of the system wherever possible.
So you've seen what you think is about $11 million increase just because of the two phases that, well, I think probably just phase one, because phase two is just rolled out, you know, just about 2 months ago. So it's mainly because of phase one that you've seen this $11 million increase?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, and it's one particular program and for us, so yes.
Okay, so I take it we won't know the full benefits of the whole system until you actually get to the rollout number four, which is in 2011?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And we'll continue to see savings along the way, but we won't see the full impact until the rollout is complete and the legacy systems are shut off.
Okay. Okay. All right, as long as we're on that topic, I figured we might as well just flesh it out here. Do you have any further, Commissioner, or any questions of the members here on integrated tax systems? Cyril C.
I hope this is the right time to ask this, but in your brochure there on page 7, you talk about data warehousing and mining. That's in this compliance book?
Well, I think we're gonna talk about the bank data match as a separate topic. I don't think we've quite got to that point yet, but we're still up to page 6 of the slide. So yeah.
Okay. I'll ask it later then.
Any other questions on integrated tax system? Okay. Commissioner, could you want to proceed with your presentation? Because I think we've still got some questions on tax compliance here. So. And apparently the integrated tax system will help with tax compliance. Is that?
Absolutely will.
Okay.
We're quite excited, actually.
Okay, move the mic closer.
The prospects of both more efficiencies and perhaps down the road, significant increases in revenue.
Okay.
If I can take you back to slide number 6, top of page 6. We were talking about the first rollout. You can see the tax types there. The conversions of tax returns, 3,355. Those are all fairly significant outcomes. We talked already a bit about rollout number 2 on the 15th. That was completed this past year. And we had a significant number of tax types that were part of that installation, including the dry cleaner tax. Some of you might wonder what that is. I believe it's a tax on dry cleaning chemicals that is part of our tax structure.
I think that was done for, it was to raise some money for the environment cleanup and so forth. Yeah, yeah. I remember that happening in the mid-90s, yeah.
Perhaps the most significant rollout, of course, would be rollout number 3, which will be completed the end of this year, and that will be the individual income tax. That's the one where we could see why we might want to put that off and make our mistakes on the smaller taxes. But we have every reason to think that that will be an uneventful rollout, hopefully. We're looking forward to that.
So do you anticipate when people are filing their individual tax returns, they probably won't see much difference. They just send them in electronically or by paper, whatever. It's just at your end that is where the issues start coming up.
Hopefully they won't know that there's been a change.
Okay.
Rollout 4 is a year later, the end of 2011, and it's the cigarette tax, liquor tax, gambling tax, and non-tax debt. So that completes the update of the integrated tax project. It's going very well, and we are now having conversations about how to institutionalize this new software into the governance structure of the Revenue Department. There's some issues that we have to work through there in terms of positions and authorities and so on. But we don't anticipate any difficult or unresolvable issues. So we're very pleased with where we are with that and expect it to be a very successful project in the end.
Senator Jungmauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have kind of an off-the-wall question here. You know, being we're in some difficult times here, I was just wondering with the integrated tax system, say somebody came up with a real out-of-the-box new tax structure, or shifting of a tax structure, how hard would it be to reset our system to change to a new tax type of structure?
Mr. Chair.
We're waiting for that question. Right.
Senator Jungmauer, I'll take a crack at it in Greg's
Commissioner
perspective. We have had to deal with changes in tax regimes almost annually as a matter of course in the department. So we're pretty good at it. And I would think we might even be able to make those transitions a lot easier with the new system. And maybe Greg some details on that.
Mr. Cheatham, yeah.
Greg Cheatham, again. Yes, Dan's exactly right. I mean, that's one of the advantages of the of purchasing a product that really is set up and to do integrated tax. The base is always there, and you just need to configure it. Now, depending upon what new thing happened, you would need some configuration changes. We are training our own staff to do most of that, and whether it's a tax on 10 people or, you know, 4 million people, it's really about the same amount of work. Now, if you came up with something really wild and out of the box that nobody's ever seen before, we might have some trouble getting it in there, but by and large, it shouldn't be that big of a problem.
Good, thanks.
Okay. Commissioner?
I think that completes the description of the integrated tax system,
okay,
unless there are questions.
Any other questions on integrated tax? Okay, go ahead.
If not, Mr. Chair, I will move on to the summary of tax compliance initiatives on page 7, top of page 7. This is the full history of our compliance initiatives starting in fiscal year 2002. I don't know the best way to summarize this, perhaps, would be to look at the rate of return on investment on the far right column. Our early days of compliance initiatives returned a 10-to-1 rate of return on the appropriation that was given to us. And as to be expected, as you do more of this, you might expect there to be diminishing returns. And that turns out to be the case, 7.5-to-1 in the 2004-05 compliance initiative, 6.4-to-1 in the 06-07. I don't know that I can explain the uptick to 6.6 in the 2008-2009, but if you look further down, you see that we get into the 4.4-to-1, and in the current initiative, the 2010-11 initiative, we are estimating, at least at this point, a 4-to-1 rate of return. So we are certainly seeing the diminishing returns, but obviously in every case, there's a net positive benefit to the state budget by doing these compliance initiatives. So we have to sort of balance that against the potential risk of having an unpleasant surprise.
Well, it seems to me under the appropriations column, that's basically what the legislature was working off of at the time, and when it says target revenues. If you go to 02-03, we were told if you spend $10.3 million, you'll get $60.1 million in return. Now, then you go to the other columns, what was actually spent and was actually received, I think is more, you know, gives a truer picture of what actually happened, but, you know, we don't always know. I mean, we're told, here's what you can expect, and that's what ultimately came out. But you can certainly see that the number keeps going down. We talked about the low-hanging fruit being gone, and at some point, some of these taxes just are not going to be collectible. I think the bottom line is what is now part of the governor's new budget proposals that came out today. I believe that this is part of his new proposals. I'm told that, you know, he's got a tax compliance component in there. We're going to be looking at that on Wednesday. But I think we have to be very careful to say, okay, is there really that much left to be done, or are we just throwing numbers in there just, you know, because – you know, we need to close the gap, and I don't know. I think now one question we're going to have is the fact that some people pay their taxes, but then they file appeals saying, I didn't really owe the money. Is that money, when it's under appeal, is that included in your forecasts, or is it excluded, or how do you handle it? Because ultimately, if the taxpayer wins the appeal and you got to pay it back, then that makes the number a little bit smaller. I don't know how that works out.
Mr. Chair, I'm told that my understanding that when we report the results as we are here, we're reporting actual collections, not assessments.
Okay. So if somebody files an appeal, you've got the money, but if they win their appeal and say they should, then you pay it back, and so then you lose the money. Is that, you know, we'll get into this at a later hearing. I just want to get a feel for what numbers we're talking about here, because this might be an inflated number.
Do you have the number?
have the experts here.
Okay, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Ostick. I'm the Financial Management Director of the Department of Revenue. The issue you're talking about with appeals, it's very slim, very low percentage that that happens.
Okay.
Most of the appeals is they do not pay the money first. They appeal it, and then they try to win that case. So it's very, very low.
So if we're now talking about spending $10.4 million to get $41.5 million, is that a realistic number? Because, again, the economy's bad. You know, I mean, you know, some of these taxes just are plain not collectible. And we've been told, you know, even a couple of years ago, saying there just isn't that much out there, but we keep coming in saying, well, okay, we'll try to squeeze a little bit more. I don't know, you know, I don't know how much more farther we can go on this one, but this is the numbers we're told, or this is what we're told. Is this a realistic number?
Mr. Chair, at this point, we believe it is. And let me just back up a little bit, too. You had asked about the governor's initiative in this.
Mm-hmm.
This line right here is the current one we have going on at the present time. There is an additional one that the governor put out that would do, I believe it's a gross of 26.8, roughly. It would net 20.1, so it's appropriation of like 6.7.
What does that work out for every dollar spent? How many do we get back to
one on that?
Four
one
to
as
one
well.
Again. Okay.
And you're right. We just don't know when that will drop off. You just, you know, you try to do it based on history of what you're collecting, and you know, that's why it's been going down, and we reduce our targets accordingly, but you just don't know when the bottom's going to drop out.
What kind of quality? I mean, you have to hire new people to collect those taxes, and at some point, is the quality of the people who are collecting taxes dropping off? I mean, at some point, you're going to have to hire new people off the street at some point.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Members, actually, we've been quite fortunate with the quality of candidates that we are receiving.
Okay.
I think that's primarily because of the state of the economy right now, but we are getting very qualified candidates who hold bachelor's, master's degrees, some PhDs. So we are very fortunate right now with the pool of candidates that we have.
Okay. And members, we're going to be looking at the governor's proposals on Wednesday, but that is part of it, as I understand. Senator Robler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I have had five town hall meetings in the last two weekends, and at both of them, at several of them, people have come up to me, and they're small business owners who have been getting audited for sales tax compliance. And in both instances, they expressed extreme frustration that the tax laws are not clear and not being explained properly. And it's not that they're trying to cheat the government out of money, but they don't know when they're supposed to be charging for sales tax or not, or even paying it. And one of it is when one of them said she had a problem because when she ordered things from other states, in particular, this was a big issue, that she had, it says, if you live in these states, you owe sales tax. But not being aware of how the law worked, she didn't believe she owed sales tax on some of those things she bought online, because she didn't know if those businesses had presences in Minnesota at all or not. It's just really unclear to people. She said, now I've gotten audited, and now I owe the sales tax, but I also owe a penalty and interest. She said, I would have been happy to pay the sales tax up front if only I would have understood how it worked. And so that's one of the big concerns she had. Another one said it was so unclear that the auditor who came out and spent days and days with his very small business, computer repair business, first she said that they had to charge sales tax on a certain type of, it wasn't even a repair. It was if he recommended that the system be replaced, that on those calls he needed to charge sales tax, it was so confusing that the auditor didn't know what she was talking about, and the poor business guy didn't understand it either. And in the end, they came to some agreement, and he's going to charge a little differently on some things, but some of the early information she provided him was inaccurate too, after she went back and talked to some of her supervisors, I suppose. And they're not trying to cheat. They just need more information. And I'm wondering if we can't increase compliance by just getting more information to these people so that they better understand what the laws are. And it is a concern because they feel bad when they get called under the scrutiny and have to pay these penalties and interest. And they spend days and days going through this. And in the one instance with the computer guy, he said, I cannot believe, he said, I had to pay $2,000 with the penalty and interest and all the sales tax that she said he didn't properly collect. But she spent days and days and days going through his invoices. And there was no gain. You know, the state paid more than they ever got out of this poor little guy, and he spent days and days and days taking away from his business to try and work with her to get this all straightened out. And so, yeah, there is a point where it just does not pay. But I think one of the main things is education, because they weren't trying to cheat. They just didn't know how to apply the law.
Any thoughts?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, there's no question that we should be doing more in the educational area. It's difficult with the right resources, but it's really part of our key issue, key activity that we should be doing. We know, for example, that we have to really beef up our website, and we have plans to do a major rewrite of that so that taxpayers can find the information they're looking for on the web more easily. Obviously, simpler tax laws often bring more clarity and make it easier for taxpayers to understand. If you look at our website and navigate, spend a little time with it, you'll see there really is a lot of information out there about various taxes and how to comply with them. But it's one of those things where it's never enough. We certainly have to continue to find better ways to communicate with taxpayers. I also suspect that with the infusion of new auditors in the field via compliance initiatives, the challenge of training them properly is a difficult one for us. So it wouldn't be unlikely to find that a taxpayer, an auditor is out there and not completely versed in the tax that they're auditing. So I think we have some work to do there as well. The training issue is one of my bullets on the challenge slide was that we need to find a way to keep these folks highly trained and proficient in what they're doing. So I'm very sympathetic, and if you have specific taxpayers that you can refer to us for additional help, we certainly be happy to help them.
Mr. Chair, members, one additional point. We're also working to do some small video presentations that will be available on our website to educate in all of the tax types. In addition to that, on the collection side, if we have collectors that are out in the field and they're struggling, they don't know the answer, we've implemented an internal, what we call CD helpline, and they can call and get a seasoned employee anytime during the day that can answer those questions real time. So if they're out there in the field and they are struggling, they've got a quicker response and they can deliver accurate information. So those are a couple of things that we're doing and working on implementing right now as well that will hopefully address some of that issue.
Mr. Chair. And I appreciate ongoing efforts like that. And I'm wondering, when people start a new business and they obviously have to apply for some kind of a sales tax, so that they can collect, and then you get them on record so that they get their submissions properly recorded. If at that point, if that information would always be provided to them right from the get-go, as they start their collection process, as they start their new business, I think that early education is the best thing we could do, because there are we want to encourage startup businesses. We want to make it easy for them. We don't want regulations to be so burdensome that everybody just throws in the towel. This little IT guy, he used to work for the Geek Squad. He broke off and started his own business. he's ready to throw the towel in because of this and all of the regulations that he has to come under that are really difficult. And so this is not how we grow our economy, is by, you know, he was hoping to someday that he'd be employing 5 or 6 people. And he might still, but he's discouraged. And we need small business people like that who are going to step up and keep thriving and not get discouraged by our laws.
Okay. Anything further? Cheryl Singh, did you have a question?
I'll wait till the end.
Okay. Okay. Anything further on tax compliance? As I say, we're going to revisit this topic as part of the governor's budget proposals. Okay. Then the last item, Mr. Commissioner, was the last slide, I think, deals with the bank data match, which was a proposal, and it was kind of controversial. So could you remind us what it does and what's been happening here?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn that over to Terry Steenblok. Terry is instrumental, I think, in getting this piece
Ms. Steenblok.
Of legislation.
Go ahead.
She's on top of it, and I think we have a good report for you.
Go ahead.
So just as a recap, the Financial Institution Data Matcher, also known as FIDM, was legislation that was enacted back in 2009. There's two options. Financial institutions can either send us all the records on account holders they have, and we match that against debtors we have, and we purge all the remaining files to find bank information or financial institution information. Or the second approach to that is that we can send all the financial institutions a list of debtors that we have, and they match that against the accounts that they have, and they send us back that information. And then our next step after that point is to do a levy to collect those funds. After the legislation was passed, we worked quite a bit with members of the financial community and came up with a process based on feedback that they provided. Had they not provided the feedback, we probably wouldn't have gone this way. So I do need to give them credit. They had suggested that we work with the Department of Human Services, who already was doing this process for child support, and implement the same process for the tax debt piece of it. And we did do some exploring with Human Services, and we were able to implement that. So the process is exactly the same as it is for the Department of Human Services. One additional step that we took is we send our file to Human Services, and we scrub out of that file anybody who owes a child support debt, because the child support debt comes before the tax debt. And then it's handled by the same vendor, does the processing for us. Everything is exactly the same with the Financial Institute data match. As of the end of December, financial institutions are required to report to us on a quarterly basis. So some of the statistics I have here are as of the end of December of 2009. But I can tell you that there's 678 financial institutions that are currently signed up and participating in that. As I mentioned, they do have to match on a quarterly basis, and they are able to choose that time frame. So most of them, or actually all of them, stay on the same time frame that they do with Department of Human Services. As of December 31st, we have received almost 52,000 matches. And what that means is there was somebody in our system that matched. We have a debt for them. So and the bank or financial institution has an account of some type available. We don't know what the dollar amount is in that account, but we know that the debtor has an asset with that particular financial institution, which gives us the opportunity at that point to issue a levy. If we're not successful with the levy, it also gives us an opportunity to maybe subpoena some of that financial information to see if we can't find other asset sources. One of the things with the reporting of this is we're always behind as far as the dollars collected or the number of matches that we've received, because they are able to do it anytime throughout the quarter. They all do it differently. The other reason why the results are behind is because we have to do our levy, and then we have to wait for the results of that levy to come back to us. So the results that you see of $6.5 million, that was through December 31st. and it doesn't include all the financial institutions matching. For example, a lot of the larger financial institutions don't match until roughly the last day or the last week of the quarter. So there are quite a few matches right now that we're currently working on because we get the matches at the end of the quarter. One of the things that I think is interesting or has been beneficial to us with this program, we note here that we had 3,787 debts referred to multiple private collection agencies. What happens is when we exhaust all of our collection actions, then we refer a debt out to a private collection agency. If they're unsuccessful in collecting, they send it back to us, and we refer it out to another private collection agency because maybe they have different tools or such. We had these 3,700 debts would not have been collected if it wasn't for the financial institution data match. These were debts where we had exhausted all of our collection options. We had had them referred out to collection agencies multiple times, and we couldn't find it. A lot of times what happens is people just kind of fall off the radar, and you can't find any information on them in order to collect. With the financial institution data match program, we were able to actually collect these debts instead of charging them off, which is what would have happened had we not had the FITM program. One of the other things to note, too, is that we did have quite a few people when we started this who had called in and said, I didn't know that you had my bank account information. I'd like to pay the debt in full so that you don't levy me anymore, or can I set up a payment plan so that you don't levy me anymore? And when we initially started the program, we were tracking that, but we had over 200 collectors that were manually tracking that, and then we had to have somebody wrap all that up and manually total all of that. So we stopped tracking the dollars that were collected as a result of that. I will tell you, when we get into rollout 3 of the integrated system, we'll start tracking that again because the system can do that for us and we don't have all that manual tracking. But there is additional revenue that has been collected as a result of that that is not reflected in the $6.5 million total, just because it was so manual to track. And then every time every month they make a payment, so then you have to track these manually every month as well to determine how much has come in over the course of this time frame. From our standpoint, we feel it's been a very successful tool for us. Obviously, we look at each case individually and look at the tools that we need to use for the debts in order to collect the debts. I again have to give the financial institutions a lot of credit. They came forward and were willing to throw out suggestions to us, and I think their help and their suggestions really made it a more successful program for us.
Ms. Steenblok, has there been any kind of a cost-benefit analysis done? Because as you've just described, it costs something from the department to have the resources to track this program and so forth. So we collected $6.5 million, but what did it cost to do that? And I recall the banks had some reservations about this because they were going to be basically given a mandate, you know, okay, here's the list, go through your records, and, you know, that wasn't going to be free to them. They had to devote some resources to do it. So at some point, between the banks and department and some other entities here, it did cost something to collect the $6.5 million. Do we have any thoughts on what that might have been?
Mr. Chair, members, one of the things that helped us tremendously on the financial institution side is that we are using the same process that we were already using for Department of Human Services. With some of the financial institutions, they did see a small increase. They are eligible per the statute to submit collections for $150. They can submit. And what we've seen thus far is the total amount submitted, and I didn't bring it with me, I'm sorry, but it is less than what we had projected for them to submit for their expenses. And if it was to be more, if there were additional funds left in that appropriation, they would be distributed to those who had additional costs. But we have not seen an increase there. As far as the Department of Revenue goes, the piece that cost us more was when we were manually tracking those people that called in and said, I want to pay it in full or I want to set up a payment plan. Outside of that, we've been able to pretty much automate the process as far as getting the files to the financial institutions and getting them back to us. So our cost has not been as great as we anticipated it either, and it has allowed our collectors then to do more in-depth asset research on those that have kind of fallen off the radar and we're trying to find in order to collect.
Any questions? Sir Olsen, did you have questions?
Yes.
Sir Olsen.
Going back to your data warehouse and mining on page 7 of this booklet, it's interesting to me because my question is going to be whether or not, as a state, we're looking at dual tracks on this. Because we toured Thomson Reuters as a model of a data center. And the thought was, my understanding was that we were going to, the goal would be to combine all the state's data into two data centers. Now, in reading this, it sounds like you guys are moving ahead with a different way of warehousing your data. And I'm just curious if OET or if there is finally a state, couple of data centers built, would you guys still continue to use a separate system or would you come back to this system?
This is Greg Cheetah. Data centers are really more of a physical location and a building, as you were. When we talk about data warehouses and data mining, it's actually taking transactional data and putting it together in a way that people can use it more. So they're really two separate items. The Office of Enterprise Technology is talking about potentially purchasing a building or working something so they can locate the servers and the rest. They really do not pay too much attention to the actual data that's there other than to make sure there's protections and things like that. They're more into, you know, buildings and servers and disks and those types of things. The actual data and the use of it, the information, that pretty much stays with the divisions. And when we talk about data warehousing and data mining, that's really taking that information and using that in a better way to get at what we're doing. And so they're not separate. I mean, they work together, but they're really two separate things.
Mr. Chair, well, that's helpful because when I think of warehousing, I think of storing stuff, and I'm thinking of
right. Servers
and all that kind of stuff. So then if the state finally does move forward, you guys would simply move your stuff into a state system then?
Right.
Or already there now?
It depends on what they have, and you know, as everybody, I think, has to do it, you take a look at, you know, can you get the business value that you need out of it, and hopefully that we would. We worked with them before, and we will continue with the Office of Enterprise Technology. And with other people, too. I mean, for the data warehousing, a lot of the data that we get is from other agencies, though even that gets a little tough once in a while because there's some data that we are precluded from actually getting from other agencies. So.
And just for the record, the governor did not recommend the data centers in his budget bonding proposal. That was not in the Senate's bill, so unless the House finds a way to do it, it's probably not going to happen, at least this cycle. So. I got a question on the data match. There were some concerns when this was proposed about the privacy of the data, making sure that it was properly secured. The financial institutions had some questions about that. I take it there are no issues that came about as when you made this transition and started implementing this program.
Mr. Chair, members, we have not, knock on wood, had any complaints to date. We did work with the financial institutions, and one of the things we did agree upon was as soon as we're done using that information, it will be immediately purged, and it is immediately purged within 2 weeks of matching that information so that we don't have the disclosure issues on our side. We also have a secure network that they're transactions are coming through, which is through our vendor, and that security piece was scoped out through the Department of Human Services when they used it, and we looked at it again. So we have not had any disclosure issues or concerns.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on revenue on these topics, tax compliance, data match, integrated tax system? Okay, thank you. That completes today's agenda. Wednesday, as I said, we're going to talk about the governor's budget recommendations. I'm preliminary told we'll get a detailed explanation, but apparently the governor is recommending a 6% agency reduction. We'll just have to see what the details are on that one.
Mr. Chairman,
and some tax compliance. Set a rest.
Most of us have seen this document.
I haven't seen anything, to be honest with you. So.
Well, this is it. Okay. Recommendations. But there are numbers without any narrative. Are we going to get narrative so that I will understand what, I mean, there's a parentheses around that I spoke with him about on the compliance initiative as a negative, and I don't understand why it's a negative rather than a positive, and you tried to explain it to me, but I sure hope we're going to get narrative and not just this bunch of numbers.
I don't know. Mr. Lundeen, do you know anything what's coming, or?
There is on the website, there is some more detail. I think you've got the summary document. There is a more detailed, but it's still not super detailed. There's a little narrative, but I think we still need additional information to fully understand.
Mr. Chairman, just to have a, you know, a category, and also just to have a number rather than what the remaining number is, like I, for one, and I think others in the policy committee will be interested. There's a $30,000, not much, I mean, in big numbers, $30,000 reduction in the problem gambling grants. But I sure would like to know, is that $30,000 reduction out of $40,000, or is it $30,000 out of $500,000. I don't understand the magnitude of the numbers, and I'm fine with reductions, and you know, everywhere we can take them, and everybody has to take them. But I'm curious about the relative reduction.
Yeah. Well, as I say, on Wednesday we may be more fully informed than we are right now. This is breaking news, so.
But Mr. Lundeen, yeah, I really need to have that, even if the governor folks aren't providing it to us right now. Just to understand it, if you don't mind.
We'll get a presentation from the legislative auditor on the Secretary of State and the Attorney General. Those reports are out, so, I mean, but they didn't go to the Legislative Audit Commission because some of those routine reports just go to the respective divisions and so forth, so they look at them. And so that's what we're going to be doing. So any other questions? If not, we'll see you Wednesday. Meeting adjourned. Thank you. Okay.
You didn't see this yet?
No, I haven't seen anything yet.